iron. He hissed in a breath and closed his eyes. She ran her fingers up the impressive length, then swiped her thumb, wonderingly across the baby-fine skin stretched across the broad head. A pearl of liquid rubbed onto her thumb, and he wrapped his fingers in a brutally tight grip around her wrist. She didn't release him, but shifted instead, raising one leg and wrapping it about his hip, opening herself to him as she guided his erection to the cleft between her thighs. He exhaled in a rush, then released her wrist, gripped her hip and her raised thigh, and anchored her as he obliged and eased, slowly, into her channel. Just a little, just past her entrance, not enough to breach her. She caught her breath and let her lids fall as a sensation rolled through her. His eyes still closed, Sebastian rocked shallowly, savouring the gentle clench of her inner muscles as the scalding slickness of paradise's vestibule coated the head of his erection. The position wouldn't do to breach her, but it had been her choice, her doing, and he saw no reason not to honour that and allow her to grow more accustomed to the sensation of him entering her body. But the moment couldn't last long. He couldn't hold back the raging tide of desperate need that crashed and churned inside him. When he could withstand it no longer, when his body felt aflame, he rolled her fully onto her back, planted his hands, palms down on the sheet on either side of her shoulders, braced his arms, and raised his chest. The movement pushed him deeper into her scalding sheath. He withdrew as far as her entrance. She didn't tense, expecting him to rock in just a little way. He locked his gaze on her face, shadowed now as the moonlight had faded, and with one sharp, powerful thrust, seated himself fully in her softness. She arched and cried out, the sound well nigh breathless. He saw the spasm of pain that crossed her face. The sight scored him like a blade, and he held still, desperately fought not to move, battled to hold against the instinct to plunder. He clung to the sight of her face, watched, waited, and sooner than he'd expected, he saw the tension born of pain fade. Then she opened her eyes. The grey orbs, brilliant and bright, stared into his eyes. Then she smiled, not tremulously, but intently. Then she reached up, dragged his head down to hers, brushed a kiss across his lips, and ordered, "Ride." She shifted beneath him in blatant invitation. He'd never before laughed at such a moment in his life. But a bark escaped him, even as he did exactly as she wanted. And at first, slowly, but increasingly forcefully, he drove them back into the fire and the flames. If he'd had any notion she might be a passive lover, she promptly shattered it. Her body rose to his. She quickly caught his rhythm, and then she was riding with him, faster, more urgently, more powerfully, on through their landscape of passion. Antonia had never dreamt such closeness could be, had never comprehended what physical intimacy truly entailed. The slide of naked limbs and intimate caresses had been one thing, but the moment when he'd thrust deep and filled her, the sensation of him there, at her core, had branded itself forever on her mind. So alien, so him. So very male. He'd held her trapped, impaled, but he'd hung suspended over her and watched her as if, in that moment, she'd been his entire world. Now her heart swelled, and her spirits rejoiced, and they thundered on through a haze of heat and hunger, and passion seared, need soared, and desire thrummed, until ecstasy hove on their horizon. Her senses had abandoned the world, and shrunk to him and her, and their joining. In that moment, nothing else existed but this. Nothing could be so important as this. This seizing, this claiming, this possession. His of her, and hers of him. They were united in that too. In their commitment, their intention, their unswerving direction. The tension mounted, stronger, more potent, more intense than before. Now that he joined with her, there was an urgency, a building desperation that flayed them and drove them both on, ever on. She clung and sobbed as that unrelenting tension ratcheted, thrust by thrust. Then, abruptly, the world fell away, and she flew. Her senses imploded in a blaze of white heat and mind-numbing pleasure. Scintillating shards of golden glory flew down her veins and cindered her hold on reality. For one instant, he held her there, on the cusp of paradise. Then, on a deep groan, he went rigid in her arms, and she felt the hot spurt of his seed deep within. Then all tension left him. As if his arms could no longer hold him, he tumbled down onto her. Instinctively, she wrapped her arms around him as far as she could reach and held him. Pleasure, bone deep, flooded her, along with a sense of togetherness she hadn't expected. His weight held her trapped, but she didn't mind. She held him close, shut her eyes, and let the oblivion that hovered just out of her senses' reach rush in and buoy them both on its tide. Antonia awoke to find herself lying on her side, with Sebastian spooned around her. She vaguely recalled, in the heated depths of the night, that he'd woken, lifted from her, then tugged her sleepy self around so he could cuddle up behind her. She grinned at the memory. And the more she recalled, the more success, sweet and very pleasurable, flowed through her veins. Then she realized she could see that although the sun was not yet up, pre-dawn light was washing through the window. She didn't know the rules of conducting a liaison, but she was fairly certain being discovered with Sebastian in his bed by some footman or maid was likely to cause a scandal. Sebastian's arm lay heavy over her waist. Moving slowly, she eased out from under it, reluctantly shifting away from the heat of his body until she could swing her feet to the floor. She pushed up to sit on the side of the bed and felt fingers lock like steel about her wrist. She glanced over her shoulder and met surprisingly intense, pale green eyes.
"You do realize," he rumbled, "that this means we're getting married?"
"Of course." The words leapt to her tongue. She arched her brows haughtily, but at the last minute held those particular words back. Instead, she smiled and let her confidence and assurance fully invest the gesture. Twisting her wrist from his grasp, she patted his naked, still quite fabulous and exceedingly distracting chest. "Let's leave that discussion for another day." That, of course, was a red rag to a bull. He immediately pushed up. Leaning on one muscled forearm, he narrowed his eyes on her face.
"What discussion? Your boldness in..."
He paused. Rising, she looked at him inquiringly. In seducing him, would he say it? His eyes narrowed even further, and his face set.
In coming to my room last night means we've leapt over all discussions. There's no longer anything left to discuss.
That was what he thought, arrogant nobleman that he was. But telling him that she wanted him to admit what he felt for her, more than anything else, so that she would know he knew, wouldn't get her what she wanted. But given what was at stake, she was willing to be patient. Heaven knew, she'd waited years, more than a decade, to get to this point. What were a few more months, if that was what it took to gain everything she'd ever sought in a marriage? She bent, scooped up her robe, and shook it out.
"You're just put out that I took the initiative and filched those particular reins from your grasp."
She shrugged on the robe.
"As I see it, as matters stand, there's no reason we need to rush into anything. We can safely leave all details until later."
Tying the sash, she flashed him a calm smile, then headed for the door. Sebastian shook his head. His wits were still not functioning. She was teasing him, wasn't she? But what the hell did she mean by leaving details until later? Details like a wedding? He glared at her silk-clad back. Then he realized and called, "Wait." She swung around and arched a brow. He kicked off the covers and got out of the bed.
"I'll escort you back to your room."
He reached for his clothes, and was grateful that she waited without further comment. Distantly, he could hear the sounds of staff rattling coal scuttles downstairs, but none would have yet ventured upstairs to the bedchambers, given the only others along their corridor were the newly married Fanshawes. Antonia returning to her room unseen should be straightforward, but still. Tucking in his shirt, he waved her back and cracked open the door. After confirming the corridor was deserted, he escorted her to her door, waited until she opened it and went in, and with a swift scan over her head, he confirmed there was no one else there. Who he'd imagined might be waiting, he had no idea, and didn't want to think too much about the impulse that had prompted him to check. With a curt nod, he left her. He halted along the corridor and waited until he heard her door shut, then returned to his room. He stood in the room's center and stared at the bed, while memories of the night poured through his head. He grunted, then walked to where he'd left his coat, fished in his pocket, drew out his watch, and opened it. It was just after 5 o'clock. He closed the watch, slipped it back into the pocket, and set about stripping again. Naked, he tumbled onto the bed. The scent of her, of the herbs in her soap, and the elemental perfume of well-loved woman, wreathed through his brain. He tugged up the covers, closed his eyes, and imagined she was still there, beside him. After their activities of the night, because of those activities, he needed more sleep if he was to have any hope of coping with her and her machinations, let alone locating the damned gunpowder. Safe inside her room, Antonia snuggled down in her bed. She might as well get another hour or two sleep while creating the impression she'd spent the night there. Smiling exceedingly smugly, feeling thoroughly pleased with herself and her world, she closed her eyes. Chapter 11. A horrendous scream rent the morning. Sebastian sat bolt upright. A second strangled scream reached him. He flung back the covers, leapt from the bed, and hauled on his trousers. Shrugging on his shirt, he strode to the door, flung it open, and stalked into the corridor. The scream had faded to sobbing whimpers coming from not that far away, on that floor in the gallery. He strode rapidly in that direction, hearing voices in the Fanshawe's room as he passed. He turned under the archway and paused. A maid stood backed against the gallery balustrade, her hands to her face, staring in abject horror through the open door to one of the main bedchambers. She was the source of the whimpers, and presumably the scream. A chill touched Sebastian's nape. He strode forward. Ignoring the maid, who, seeing him approaching, pointed into the room and gibbered, he walked to the open doorway. He halted on the threshold and looked into the room. As he'd feared, it was Cecilia's bedroom. From where he stood, he could see only the end of the large bed. And her feet, one bare, the other with a feathered high-heeled slipper dangling. The other slipper lay on the rug at the foot of the bed. The hem of a filmy peignoir lay rucked about Cecilia's calves. Away from the bed, closer to the door, a heavy pewter jug lay rolling on one side, the water it had contained pooling on the floorboards. The sounds of rushing footsteps, of exclamations and questions, fell on Sebastian's ears, but he blocked out the distraction. He drew in a too shallow breath, held it, and stepped into the room. Two paces and he halted, his gaze riveted by the crumpled, doll-like body tossed on the bed. Cecilia was dead. Her eyes were wide open, staring up at the ceiling. Her fair hair was still up in the elaborate French knot she'd favoured the previous evening. She was clad in a silk nightgown and the peignoir, both in shades of pink. Neither garment hid the bruises circling her throat, like some gruesome necklace. Sebastian hailed in a quiet rush. Despite her faults, Cecilia had been a lively woman with whom he'd once shared a bed. She hadn't been evil, but evil had come looking for her. Behind him, the maid was now sobbing freely. He felt cold, chilled, and hollow. Brusque voices drew nearer. Some of the other men entered the room. Like him, they halted just inside the door. A detached part of his brain noted that the bed was still made. Cecilia's body had been flung on the undisturbed coverlet. There was no sign of a struggle on the counterpane. She'd been dead before she'd been tossed there. He scanned the room. There was no sign of a struggle anywhere, no rucked rug, nothing disturbed or out of place. Amid the press of males all uttering horrified exclamations, Sebastian sensed a softer presence slip through the door and draw nearer. Instinctively, he shifted to block her view, but Antonia gripped his upper arm and held him still. She glanced at the body on the bed. Then she looked up at him, briefly studied his face. Then her fingers slipped into his. He closed his hand around hers and gripped, tightly, as if she was his anchor to the world. Hadley Fanshawe, who had halted, transfixed and aghast, at Sebastian's side, was the first to voice the obvious question.
What should we do?
Drawn back to reality by the feel of Antonia's fingers in his, Sebastian hauled in a deeper, freer breath and stated,
We send for the doctor, and we send word to Sir Humphrey's house and summon Inspector Crawford.
Sebastian stood before the fireplace in the estate office and stared at the flames leaping in the grate.
I didn't kill her.
His tone was flat, emotionless. He honestly wasn't sure what he felt. Crawford humphed. At least, this time, you weren't the one who found the body.
Could the maid tell you anything?
Antonia asked. Sebastian glanced at her. She was sitting in one of the chairs before the desk, behind which the inspector and Sir Humphrey sat. The two men had arrived several hours ago. They had consulted with the doctor, who had been waiting to make his report before continuing with his day. Then magistrate and policeman had been waylaid by several of the guests, with whom they'd briefly spoken. Subsequently, they'd examined the scene and talked with a number of the staff. When eventually Crawford and Sir Humphrey had come into the drawing room, where all the guests had gathered after a hurried breakfast, they had made a general statement that they intended to interview everyone again. Then they'd asked to speak with Sebastian. He'd pushed away from the mantelpiece against which he'd been leaning and joined the two men, and Antonia had risen and walked with them into the front hall. When he turned to her, intending to insist she remain with the others, she'd been waiting to catch his eye, with a very definite challenge in hers. Instead of imposing his will, he'd cravenly surrendered. He hadn't been up to fighting himself as well as her. Neither Sir Humphrey nor the inspector, both of whom had taken in that brief but wordless exchange, had ventured to try to dissuade or deny her. In reply to her question, Sir Humphrey snorted,
"Silly female keeps dissolving into hysterics, but in between, we got out of her that she'd opened the door to take in her mistress's washing water, saw Lady Ennis, as we found her, dropped the jug, screamed, and backed out of the room." Sir Humphrey raised his gaze to Sebastian. "She said you were the first to arrive."
Sebastian nodded. "Her first scream woke me. Unsurprisingly, I rushed to see what had happened."
"Who was the next to arrive?" Crawford asked.
Sebastian frowned.
"I'm not sure. I was transfixed by the body, but it might have been Fanshawe."
He drew breath and exhaled.
"I heard his voice as I passed their room on the way to the gallery, and Cecilia's room is closer to the east wing, where our rooms, mine, the Fanshawe's, and Lady Antonia's, are."
"When I arrived..."
Antonia's voice was calm and composed.
"Most of the men were already there. Mr. Parrish and Mr. McGibbon were just going into the room, and Mr. Boyne followed me in. The women were still arriving, but most stayed in the gallery."
The inspector grunted. He read through the notes before him, then glanced sidelong at Sir Humphrey. Antonia watched the magistrate and the inspector exchange a long glance, some wordless communication. Then Sir Humphrey grimaced faintly. He shifted, then clasped his hands on the desk and looked at Sebastian, who was, once again, staring at the flames. Sir Humphrey cleared his throat, then said,
"It's been suggested, not an accusation, mind, but merely a mention, that on the face of things, you, Lord Irith, might be seen as the most likely suspect for both murders."
Antonia watched as a curious, quite menacing stillness stole over Sebastian's tall frame. Then slowly, he turned his head and looked at Sir Humphrey. For long enough for Sir Humphrey's normally ruddy complexion to pale. Then Sebastian blinked, slowly, his long lashes momentarily screening his piercingly pale green eyes, and in a tone of voice that reminded any who heard it who and what he was, he quietly asked,
"On what grounds?"
The inspector darted a glance Antonia's way.
"The motive appears somewhat hazy."
"Indeed."
Sebastian's diction, clipped hard and rigidly even, was the equivalent of a screamed warning to any who knew him. He straightened and took two prowling steps to stand behind the vacant chair facing the desk, the better to fix both Sir Humphrey and the inspector with his intimidating gaze. Antonia knew perfectly well what motive had been mooted, and knew he knew it too. But he would put Sir Humphrey and the inspector through a metal-spiked ringer before allowing his long-ago liaison with Cecilia to be mentioned in such a context, and they didn't have time for such distractions. She fixed her gaze on the inspector and her own voice, even, but considerably lighter in tone, asked,
"Did the doctor give you an estimate of when, what time, Lady Ennis was killed?"
From the corner of her eye, she saw Sebastian's eyes widen, fractionally. Then he turned his intimidating look on her. She ignored it, and kept her gaze on the inspector. Faintly puzzled, but willing, anything to ease the oppressive tension in the room, Crawford hurriedly consulted his notes. "It seems clear that her ladyship was killed in the hours after she retired. She summoned her maid at about 10:30, and the maid left her mistress sitting at her dressing table at 11:00. The clocks were striking the hour as the maid left. The doctor has declared that her ladyship was murdered sometime in the following 3 hours.
So between 11:00 and 2:00 in the morning."
Antonia arched her brows.
"In that case..."
"Antonia."
Sebastian's warning growl, gritted out through clenched teeth, held overtones of disbelief. Unperturbed, she continued,
"Erith couldn't possibly have murdered her ladyship. Throughout those hours, he was with me. Or rather, I was with him, in his room, and I would definitely have noticed if he'd left."
Silence greeted her pronouncement, as if all three men couldn't quite believe she'd said what she had. Crawford stared at her. Sir Humphrey blinked several times and looked increasingly uncomfortable and unable to decide where to look, at her or Sebastian or the desk. As for Sebastian, she could feel his gaze locked on the side of her face. She was about to glance his way when he gripped the back of the chair in front of him, straightened to his full height, and faced the other two men.
"Lady Antonia and I are unofficially betrothed."
She managed to stop her reaction from showing, her eyebrows from flying upward. When Antonia glanced at him, Sebastian met her gaze levelly. He felt curiously calm, as if stating the truth aloud had been somehow freeing, settling. It had certainly given his inner self an unanticipated degree of satisfaction. He held her grey gaze, daring her to attempt any contradiction. She briefly searched his face, his eyes. Then her fine brows faintly arched, and she turned back to the inspector and Sir Humphrey, and let the statement lie unchallenged.
"Thank God."
Given the cauldron of emotions the current situation had stirred inside him, he wasn't sure how he might react if she attempted to argue. He refocused his attention on the inspector and Sir Humphrey.
"To have two murders committed in the same household in the space of little more than 24 hours, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the murders are connected. It's possible whoever murdered Ennis feared he had shared something with his wife, enough for her to prove a potential threat. And so her ladyship was silenced too."
Crawford was happy to move on. "I agree. That is, indeed, the most likely scenario."
"As to that," Antonia said, "when the company was going up the stairs last night, Cecilia seemed anxious, even nervous, over something. We all heard her."
Antonia glanced up at Sebastian. He met her gaze and nodded. To the inspector and Sir Humphrey, he said,
"She spoke of escaping this place. She claimed it was the atmosphere, but..."
He shrugged.
"I felt she was bothered over something, but also playing some sort of role."
Antonia added,
"I thought she seemed frightened, but it was an amorphous fear, as if she suspected one of the company of murdering Ennis, but didn't know who, which one, it was."
Sir Humphrey tugged at his earlobe.
"That she was frightened suggests
She had reason to imagine the murderer might come after her.
True.
Sebastian let go of the chair, rounded it, and sat.
It's possible she didn't know who the killer was, but had guessed what motive lay behind Ennis's murder, and knew, therefore, that the murderer might suspect she knew enough of the plot to also pose a threat to him. Regardless, she didn't suspect the man who murdered her. There was no sign of any struggle. She was taken entirely unawares.
He paused, then arched his brows.
Much as with Ennis. Neither he nor Cecilia felt threatened by the murderer until he struck.
Very well. Crawford looked down at his jottings. The murderer is a man. No woman could have strangled her ladyship, not with their bare hands, as was done. So who among the male guests remain on our list of suspects? The inspector looked at Sebastian, then at Antonia. Could any of the other men have been involved with her ladyship? Antonia glanced at Sebastian.
I saw nothing that made me think so.
Sebastian looked at Sir Humphrey.
It's possible, but I wasn't specifically watching for signs of it.
You might try asking the older ladies, Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon,
Antonia said.
If Lady Ennis had had a lover among the guests, they are more likely to have noticed. However, those ladies' husbands would have to go on your list of possibles, with the Ennises, the Parrishes, and the McGibbons. Husbands and wives have separate rooms.
She paused, then added,
The only men you can strike from your list are Erith and Mr. Fanshawe. Hadley and Georgia are newlyweds, and Georgia would certainly know if Hadley crept out, quite aside from him not being that way inclined.
Sir Humphrey cleared his throat.
Just so.
He glanced at the list the inspector had compiled.
That leaves us with rather a lot of possibles for the positions of murderer and her ladyship's lover.
And, Sebastian added dryly, the murderer and her lover could be one and the same.
Antonia blinked.
Actually, there's something we've forgotten to mention.
She glanced at Sebastian.
In the conservatory yesterday evening, we overheard Filbury and Wilson speaking with Cecilia. We were out of sight, and they assumed they were speaking in private. This was a little before we all retired.
Crawford looked keen. He leaned forward.
What was said?
Antonia frowned, clearly trying to recall. Sebastian couldn't help her. His recollection of those moments had been largely overwritten by more vivid memories of the taste of her lips, the feel of her in his arms.
They, the two men, were asking about the Irish estate.
Antonia glanced at him. He met her gaze and fractionally shook his head. Apparently realizing he couldn't remember, she looked at Crawford and went on.
They couched their queries in terms of being friends of the family and friends of Connell. In essence, they wanted to know if there was anything going on there, on the estate, to cause concern. Cecilia didn't seem to know of anything amiss.
So,
Sir Humphrey narrowed his eyes.
Filbury and Wilson could simply have been asking as concerned friends, as they claimed. Or they might have been sounding out her ladyship to see what she knew of whatever this is that's going on, which seems somehow connected with Ireland.
Exactly.
Antonia nodded. After a moment, Crawford sighed and closed his notebook.
If only Lady Ennis had told us what she'd suspected, she might still be alive.
Sebastian stared at the inspector for a moment, then grimaced.
In defense of her ladyship, there might not have been time. I think her suspicions evolved through the day, the longer she thought about her husband's murder.
Crawford grunted, but acknowledged the point with a nod.
We're going to be busy all day here, interviewing everyone again, all of the guests, and then all of the staff, one by one. If luck comes our way, we might find one of the staff, either those of the household or those visiting, who glimpse one of the male guests slipping through the corridors. That said, the way these cases tend to go, I won't be holding my breath. No one ever seems to witness the murderers moving back and forth. Sir Humphrey looked questioningly at Sebastian. Any luck with your search for this gunpowder?
No.
He glanced at the magistrate.
But we did find 4 very old casks, most likely of brandy, hidden in the crypt of the old ruined chapel.
Did you, by Jove? Sir Humphrey looked enthused. Any good?
Sebastian suppressed a wry grin.
I've yet to tell Blanchard. No doubt he'll send a couple of footmen to retrieve the casks.
However, the find made me wonder if there might be other hidden places, or perhaps a secret tunnel connecting the house to caves, or even to the shore. Pressingstoke Hall isn't that far from the sea, and this has been a smuggler's coast for centuries. He fixed Sir Humphrey with an inquiring look.
I've heard that was often the way with old houses in this area in times past, but I checked this morning, and there was no hidden place or tunnel marked on the house plans, even on the older iterations.
Ah! Sir Humphrey tapped the side of his nose. But there wouldn't be anything marked on the plans. Wouldn't be a secret then, what? But indeed, you're right. While what's around us? With one hand, he waved at the walls surrounding them. Is relatively new. It's built on a much older base, one dating from an age when having a secret tunnel into a cave system at least, if not directly to the shore, was the norm. The inspector looked intrigued. Wouldn't the finding of casks in this crypt suggest there wasn't such a tunnel?
Not necessarily, Sir Humphrey said. 2 different routes for 2 different levels of involvement. If the master of the house was dealing directly with the smugglers, the secret tunnel and the caves it accessed would be used. But if the master wasn't involved, then the casks left in the crypt are the smuggler's payment for him looking the other way. That's how the system worked in these parts.
Sebastian pulled a face and uncrossed his legs.
Regardless, we found no hint or trace of anything resembling barrels of gunpowder inside the house or in the grounds. We'll need to expand our search to the rest of the estate.
He rose, and Antonia smoothly came to her feet. Crawford and Sir Humphrey rose as well. Sebastian nodded to them both.
If you need us, we'll be riding over the fields, quartering the estate from the western edge to the coast.
Crawford glanced at Sir Humphrey. We'd better get on interviewing the rest. One of the men has to be our murderer. We just have to find clues enough to point to him.
We'll leave you to it.
Sebastian took Antonia's elbow.
Gentlemen.
With a nod to Sir Humphrey and the inspector, she let him escort her to the door. Antonia changed into her riding habit, then joined Sebastian at the side door. He'd already been wearing buckskin breeches and riding boots, topped with a soft linen shirt and a hacking jacket. A plain cravat completed the outfit. He might have been the model for what the fashionable Marquis was wearing this year for riding about the countryside.
So where are we heading first?
She stepped through the door he held for her, then, tugging on her gloves, walked briskly down the path toward the stable. He fell in at her side, striding with long-legged ease. It occurred to her that the shock of Cecilia's murder had leapfrogged them, her and Sebastian, over the awkwardness she'd assumed would attend their first meeting after being intimate. They'd been plunged into dealing with the ramifications of the murder, and of course, instantly, without the slightest hesitation on either of their parts, had banded together to face the situation.
Before we get to that.
His voice was a deep murmur, but his tone was definite enough to be one step away from invincible.
I should make clear that as far as I'm concerned, all that I told Sir Humphrey and Crawford about us, you and me, is the simple, unvarnished, and inviolable truth.
She considered that, considered how she wished to respond, then briskly nodded.
Duly noted.
From the corner of her eye, she saw his expression fleetingly register complete bafflement. Then his features hardened, and he shot a glance, brimming with suspicion, her way. She pretended not to notice. Only her excellent training allowed her to keep her grin from her face. They reached the stable yard, and he asked for their mounts of yesterday to be saddled. Had it been only yesterday? It seemed longer. So much had happened in such a short time. She'd appropriated the map of the estate they'd found, and had made a rough copy on a smaller sheet. She drew it from her pocket and unfolded it. Studying it, she tried to estimate the area they had to cover.
Where to first?
He came to look over her shoulder. After a moment, he grunted.
North or south? We can't effectively do both in what's left of today.
It was already late morning. She turned as he fished a coin from his breeches pocket. He tossed the coin, caught it, slapped it onto his wrist, and covered it with his palm.
Heads, we search north. Tails, we look to the south.
He lifted his hand. She leaned nearer to peer at the coin.
Tails.
She straightened and looked southward.
I meant search the southern half of the estate.
He turned as with hooves clopping, the horses were brought out.
We'll go west to the road, then zigzag over the southern half of the estate and return via the coastal path, stopping at all possible hiding places we come upon.
She steeled herself to weather the sensual jolt as he grasped her waist and hoisted her to her saddle,
as if she weighed very little, which she knew was not the case.
She was pleased to discover that, although the thrill to her senses was still there, the discombobulation had faded. Her wits remained hers to command. The instant he'd swung up to his saddle, she shook the chestnut's reins and led the way out of the yard, but then had to wait for him to set their course, which he did by taking the lead on the large, raw-bone grey. She urged her mare up to keep pace, riding to the side and half a length behind, sufficiently to the rear to respond to any change in direction he made. Although she suspected her map-reading skills were superior to his, he had a landowner's sense of north, south, east, and west. He led them unerringly west, toward the road linking Deal with Dover that formed the estate's western boundary. But as they rode, they zigged and zagged, stopping at barns and sheds to search. At the third such stop, when they emerged from a shed having found no sign of any barrels, she halted and glanced up at the sky, at the sun moving steadily west behind the scudding clouds.
I wonder what the others will think of us being allowed to ride out freely, even after Cecilia's murder.
She glanced at Sebastian as he halted beside her.
You don't think it'll mark us as working with the authorities, especially to the murderer?
His gaze scanning the fields before them, he considered, then shook his head.
Even now, I think their first assumption will be that I, and you too, are pulling rank, purely to get out of the house. After all, if we insisted on riding, what could Sir Humphrey or Crawford do to stop us? The others know we haven't left. And as for the murderer, although he has no doubt guessed that I was the one Ennis intended to speak with, as apparently Ennis was dead before I found him, there's no sense in the murderer risking showing his hand by attempting to silence me.
He met her gaze.
As I learn nothing from Ennis, I can't be a threat, unlike poor Cecilia, who Ennis might have confided in.
She humphed, and tried to stifle a persistent sense of unease, not on her account, but on his. He gestured to their horses, and she walked beside him to where they tethered their mounts to the branches of a stunted tree.
Still, she persevered, I can't help feeling that the company at large might start to question your purpose in being here. Our excuse, that you're here as my father decreed escort, while acceptable, is hardly unshakably convincing.
He lifted her to her saddle. As he swung up to his, he slanted an amused glance her way.
After the events of yesterday evening and this morning, I believe my presence here will have been adequately explained to all. Far from imagining I'm here pursuing some intrigue, I'd wager the question exercising Mrs. Parrish's and Mrs. McGibbon's minds will be whether your father knows I'm here with you at all.
She humphed and turned the chestnut's head once more to the west.
Our relationship, our connection, is not that obvious, and I'm sure Wilson and Filbury are gentlemen enough to be discreet.
His expression stated he thought she was indulging in fantasy, but he said nothing more, just nudged the grey into the lead again. But when next they stopped, at a hay shed, and he lifted her down, he said,
You need to remember that all those remaining at Pressingstoke Hall know me only by repute. Not even Cecilia knew I know Drake beyond a nodding acquaintance. You know otherwise. You also know Drake. But for most of the Haut Ton, let alone wider society, there's no reason for anyone to suspect that the Marquis of Irith might occasionally undertake missions for Winchelsea and his Home Office masters.
She considered that as they circled the hay shed, then checked inside. And some of her nebulous anxiety faded. After concluding that there was nothing concealed among the bales of hay, they walked back to the horses. She halted by the mare's side and faced him.
How occasionally do you work for Drake?
He lifted her to her saddle, then shrugged as he turned and gathered the grey's reins.
A few times a year.
He mounted, then widened his eyes at her.
But of course, the sons of dukes can't ever be even vaguely associated with anything like work.
She grinned at his tone. Then he wheeled the grey, and she followed him on. They reached the Deal Dover Road at the village of Ringwald, and stopped at the inn, the Five Bells, for lunch. While seated at a table in the corner of the tap, and consuming portions of an excellent rabbit pie, they debated the wisdom of asking the locals about any recent smuggler-like activity, and decided against it. Sebastian grimaced and concluded,
It's too difficult to clarify exactly what we're asking about.
To Antonia's mind, it was simply too risky. People asking about smugglers on this coast, she'd heard too many tales.
Besides, we aren't really concerned with the mechanism by which the gunpowder got here, but rather with the stuff itself.
His eyes on his plate, Sebastian nodded.
True.
He swallowed.
And even if they know something, they won't tell us. Neither of us are locals.
After finishing their meal, they mounted up again, and this time swept south, riding a few hundred yards inside the boundary, and diverting to search any building they spotted. They halted at two cottages, and Sebastian used his title as license to search the associated sheds and barns, to no avail. After searching two more hay sheds, they reached the estate's southern boundary and swung east toward the coast. They came upon three abandoned huts and an isolated ruin of a cottage, but none of the structures held barrels of anything. Eventually, with the sun sliding down the western sky, and the clouds massing more thickly overhead, they reached the coast just north of the next village. The tide was out, and the increasingly brisk wind set narrow white crests rearing on the grey-green waves. A bridle path meandered along the edge of the cliffs. They turned their horses' heads to the north and cantered along the path, scanning both the sands below and the nearby fields. Again, they turned aside to search cottages, barns, and sheds. Again, they found nothing. The sands at the base of the cliffs along which they rode remained smooth and unmarred. Drawing rein at a point he judged to be level with Pressingstoke Hall, Sebastian studied the pale sands.
"It looks like the tide comes up high enough to wash away any signs of activity on the beach."
He looked northward along the cliffs.
"If tomorrow we find nothing on the northern half of the estate, we'll try riding along the beach. There'll be caves in the cliffs, but whether we'll come upon the right one, much less that there'll be anything there to find, who knows?"
Beside him on her chestnut, Antonia shrugged.
"If we find nothing tomorrow, it'll be worth a try."
While they continued northward, keeping to the bridle path, Sebastian pondered the likelihood of caves and how best to address that. They spotted two more hay sheds and turned aside to search them, but there was nothing to be found amid the tightly packed bales. The day was closing in. He halted the grey above a steep dip where the bridle path dropped across a tiny lane that led all the way down to the sands. On the other side of the lane, there was a scattering of cottages built on a narrow rocky shelf that jutted out from the base of the cliff. Folding his hands on the pommel, he revisited their strategy.
"Gunpowder, here."
He could still hear Ennis's strained voice gasping the words.
What precisely did Ennis mean? Was the gunpowder already here, or was it going to be brought here sometime in the future?
He glanced at Antonia. She had halted the chestnut alongside the grey.
"Is gunpowder here now? Or is it on its way here? Or was it here last week or earlier? But even when Ennis died, had it already been moved on? Or did Ennis mean something else entirely by the word here?"
She met his eyes, then shook her head and looked out at the pristine wave-washed sands.
"There's no way we can tell, and no benefit in speculating. All we can do is what we're doing, searching everywhere we can think of to at least confirm that the gunpowder is, as far as we can tell, not in Ennis's house or on his estate. At least, not at this time."
He thought through her words, then grimly nodded.
"You're right. And if we find no trace here in the next few days, we'll take what we know back to London and hope Drake's returned so he can decide where next to search or what next to do."
The chestnut shifted. Acting instinctively, she settled the horse, then said,
"Would it be better to leave and go back to London immediately?"
She met his gaze.
"Even if Drake's not back, you or your father, or Drake's, could find out who to contact in the Home Office."
He considered that, then slowly shook his head.
"Crawford and Sir Humphrey will hold those at the house party at Pressingstoke Hall as long as they can, in the hope of identifying the murderer. Crawford is thorough. There's a good chance he'll flush the beggar out. If he does, then assuming we don't find the gunpowder ourselves, learning the identity of the murderer and all he knows of the plot will be our best route to locating the stuff."
Elucidating his thoughts aloud confirmed their logic. He glanced at her, saw her agreement in the set of her features, smiled faintly, and turned the grey's head for the house.
"It's starting to get dark. We'd better get back."
She nodded and wheeled the chestnut.
"And tomorrow, We'll search the northern half of the estate, assuming we don't ride in and discover that Sir Humphrey and the inspector have the murderer by the collar.
Chapter 12. They clattered into the stable yard, with the shadows deepening, and discovered Inspector Crawford seated on the mounting block. He rose and stretched, then waited while Sebastian dismounted, lifted Antonia down, and the stable lads gathered their reins. As the boys led the horses away, Sebastian and Antonia turned to the inspector. Crawford tipped his head toward the house.
"My lord, my lady,
if you would walk with me a little way, I'd like to pick your brains." Antonia shot Sebastian a questioning look, but when he just took her hand and wound her arm in his, she fell in beside him. With Crawford pacing on Sebastian's other side, they strolled to a point halfway back to the house, where the rising slope and a stand of trees combined to screen them from the windows. Crawford halted and faced them.
"I take it your search wasn't successful?"
"No."
Sebastian's reply was coloured by his frustration.
"But we've yet to search the northern half of the estate. We'll do that tomorrow. If we find nothing, we might well have to rely on the murderer for further information."
Crawford's brows rose.
"Do you think he'll talk?"
"Eventually."
Crawford eyed Sebastian's face for a second, then plainly decided to let that subject go.
"Did you find the money?"
Antonia asked.
"The £300.
"No." Crawford glanced at Sebastian. "The search went well enough. We searched all the gents' rooms and those of the visiting staff, and none of them the wiser, but came up empty-handed."
Crawford looked at Antonia. "So we used your suggestion to get the gents to turn out their pockets, but no one was carrying any roll of banknotes." Sebastian grimaced.
"It was worth a try."
He paused, then in a more pensive tone added,
"So where has the money gone?"
His expression tending grim. Crawford nodded.
"I've been wondering how much gunpowder is worth."
"But if the money's been handed over..."
Antonia met Sebastian's eyes.
"Doesn't that mean the gunpowder is here? Somewhere near?"
Sebastian's expression hardened, and he nodded.
"Or at least it was. And that line of thinking confirms that the murderer, who must have taken the money from Ennis, is also the person involved in this plot, the person dealing with the gunpowder."
He focused on the inspector.
"Are you any closer to identifying the murderer?"
Crawford sighed.
"That was why I was waiting for you two. I wanted to discuss with you both."
The inspector included Antonia with his gaze. "The matter of alibis. All the guests have alibis of sorts for Ennis's murder, but only a few guests have alibis for her ladyship's murder. Yet the simple truth is that other than the pair of you and the Fanshawes, none of the other guests can have any reasonable alibi for the second murder. They were all in their beds in their separate rooms, all supposedly alone. So we're back to focusing on who had the chance, the opportunity, to murder Lord Ennis. Sir Humphrey suggested I run the gentleman's alibis past the pair of you, in the hope you'll see something neither of us have." Sebastian nodded and settled to listen. Crawford tugged his notebook from his pocket. "If we assume that the murders were committed by the same person, and please God that's true, then the one thing we can take from her ladyship's murder is that the murderer is a man. So we're concentrating on the alibis of the men, and that the ladies all had solid alibis for Lord Ennis's murder only underscores that our approach is correct. The murderer must be one of the male guests." Crawford glanced at Sebastian. Again, Sebastian nodded.
"That conclusion seems inescapable. I can't see Cecilia, dressed as she was, opening her door and admitting a male servant.
Whoever strangled her was a gentleman she knew, ergo, one of the male guests.
Indeed.
Crawford flicked open his notebook. He leafed through several pages, then tapped his finger on an entry.
Here we are.
The alibis of the male guests for the time of Lord Ennis's murder. To remind you, my lord, other than yourself and Lord Ennis, there are 7 male guests to account for, and the period in question is quite short, from roughly 9:30 to 10:00. For argument's sake, let's say that Ennis left the dining room at 9:30, and as he'd intimated, went straight to his study. We have no reports from anyone of seeing him anywhere else. So, Ennis was in his study by, say, 9:32. Next, McGibbon, Worthington, Filbury, and Wilson left the dining room for the billiards room. According to McGibbon, that was at 9:40. McGibbon and Worthington went straight to the billiards room, passing the study on the way. According to the pair of them, the study door was closed. They stayed in the billiards room, chatting and waiting for the other two. According to McGibbon and Worthington, neither of them left the billiards room until the ruckus, when you found Ennis dead. The inspector paused to turn over a page. Filbury and Wilson, however, did not go directly to the billiards room. They parted from McGibbon and Worthington in the front hall. And this is where things get interesting. According to Filbury and Wilson, they paused to chat near the gun room. They saw Boyne, who we'll come to in a moment, go into the library, but they don't think he saw them, and Boyne said he didn't. Filbury and Wilson then went out through the door onto the rear terrace and so down onto the lawn. There they smoked cheroots, but they didn't remain together. Wilson says he went off to wander through the rose garden. Apparently the design of such places is of interest to him. While Filbury says he ambled slowly around the lawns to the western side of the house. As you're no doubt aware, my lord, there's a small porch and an external door to the billiards room. Filbury, and later Wilson, entered the billiards room through that door, joining Worthington and McGibbon. Of necessity, both Filbury and Wilson passed Ennis's study window. But apparently, neither noticed whether it was open or not. Neither of them heard anything either. Crawford humphed. Worthington, McGibbon, Filbury and Wilson then started their game of billiards, and it was some time later, between 5 and 10 minutes, they all say, that you raised the alarm. Crawford glanced up. So that's those 4. He turned another page and went on. The next gentleman to leave the dining room, virtually on the earlier 4's heels, was Boyne. He says he went into the library to the far end, sat in an armchair and settled to read a book. Filbury and Wilson saw him enter the room, more or less at the time he says he did. Later,